Good morning, all. Our first case for argument this morning is Morocco versus funds in the amount of $100,000. Mr. Comey.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleasure to be here in my 37th year and appear before you. I tried the Erie Bank robbery case with you. I tried the electrician on the Amtrak case with you, but I've never had the privilege of trying a case with you.
Well, I've only been here 25 years, so you'll get changed.
It's very modest of you not to mention the case where you actually got an acquittal by the bench.
Well, those are so few and far in between, you know. But it was a blessing when it happened. Well, good morning. And this is a summary judgment case, as you well know. And it's a summary judgment case that we believe should be reversed by you, because the district court parsed the affidavits which opposed summary judgment. The trial court granted summary judgment by viewing the affidavits in the light most favorable to the government instead of to the opponent of the movement. Our appendix has those affidavits in it for you to review. The district court examined the affidavits as though the affidavits were physical witnesses sitting on a witness stand testifying, and the district court made credibility judgments on an affidavit. And that, as I understand the jurisprudence of our circuit, is forbidden.
If the court found that your experts were not properly qualified as experts, what standard of review would we apply to that determination? I mean, isn't that essentially what she said, that your experts weren't qualified or helpful? And that does seem to be the case with Croyer, whose credentials seem, you know, thin.
Well, in the case of a judge who actually hears a physical witness, you have a very deferential standard of abuse of discretion. But when you're looking at affidavits, we don't have that deferential view. We, as I understand our jurisprudence of the circuit, we're looking at a situation where a judge has to look at the affidavit, make no credibility decision, but really determine whether there's an issue of fact to be resolved by a fact finder. So the de novo standard, and I've never seen a case where the de novo standard is sliced and diced like we see when we look at search and seizure, when you have mixed questions of fact and law, where a judge has actually heard witnesses, and the witnesses of the judge says, well, I find Joe uncredible. I can't believe anything Joe says, but I also find Officer so-and-so credible. Then you have a mixed standard, because the judge has made a credibility determination looking at the body language and the historical constellation of things judge look at when they make credibility determinations. But in summary judgment, how can you make on paper? And, you know, we made a conscious decision as a country back when we were founded not to follow the French system where judges make credibility decisions on affidavits. I watched the trial of a pickpocket in Monaco where the judge decides the credibility of witnesses based on reading affidavits of witnesses from the pickpocket in the casino taking a wallet. And yet the judge never saw one of those witnesses sit in front of him and talk about it. Now, ironically enough, because it was an Illinois bar delegation, they found the pickpocket not guilty of part of the stealing, because I think that was because we were sitting there.
What evidence is it that is needs to be heard?
I'm sorry?
What evidence, credibility, what is the issue that you need heard that
we need
should
a
not
trial.
Be judged on summary judgment?
We need a trial.
On what issue?
We need a trial on all the issues here, because we were never given a trial to determine whether or not this money was related to drugs. This whole thing turns around a dog sniff. And if I can try to bring you into where we stand, the government spoliates the evidence to start with. The money travels from there to the bank so that there is no laboratory involved anywhere in the process. Now, you know, if I may digress a second, when I met Lord Abernathy, who tried the Lockerbie bombing case, the FBI was able to trace the clock that blew up, that ignited the bomb, all the way back to a timer that was sold in Malta. And it was because when the bomb blew up, a piece of the clock got caught in the woman's pantyhose that was in the suitcase, designed to disguise it as a, you know, just a normal suitcase. They sent that to the laboratory in Washington, and they were able to trace that all the way back to a Malta clock shop.
Was there any other scrutiny of the money than the dog?
Was there any what?
Scrutiny, examination of the currency.
No, Denny the dog is the preeminent scientific
authority.
They call
him Denny or Deny.
What's that?
Denny or Deny.
I think it's Denny, but...
Denny's got two N's.
I'd like to call him Deny, but...
That's what he is. Okay, but I'm asking that.
Yeah, he's the only source of the scientific evidence in the case the government relies on. And we provided the affidavit of Stanford Angelos, who says 85% of the currency or better in the United States is contaminated because of the rollers at the Federal Reserve Bank. And so, you know, we even provided affidavits as to where the Chemical Society of America stood as to the fact that all the chemists in America understand all the currency is contaminated. Washington, D.C., 95% of the currency is contaminated.
Long time ago, we had a case that you may have looked at, that's when the restaurant, Greek restaurant, and they had $500,000 cash.
506?
Yeah, you know the case. And that we determined, based on what you're saying, I think in the interim, we've diminished that presumption that everything's contaminated.
Well,
maybe that's coming back. I don't know.
That may be an accident of not observing the science of the 21st century. You know, sometimes law and science don't quite intersect at the same moment in time. But here we have a situation where it's well recognized by the scientists of our country of the contamination of the currency. And it's only because of the jurisprudence of, I think, 30,000 that we sort of got away from the fact. I mean, Miss Reno, how likely is Miss Reno going to be smoking cocaine? Or doing cocaine, yet her purse was discovered by a dog to be active. Judge Bauer wrote about that in USA versus 506,000. And that was well known. It was published in the American Bar Association Journal. I mean, it was well throughout the legal community that Janet Reno had cocaine in her purse, according to the dog, which was highly unlikely and probably would have, resulted in another acquittal of Miss Reno if she ever had been placed on a trial.
Well, what scientific evidence that you would want to present that would challenge the method that they used and how it was used?
We would present chemical evidence that the currency is contaminated. We would present evidence of the training of the dog. We're regarding the dog. As we know from Florida versus Harris, the Supreme Court supports the idea there should be a hearing where a judge makes a credibility determination. In the case of a jury trial, it would be an actual jury that would make that determination if we don't have a Daubert hearing ahead of time. But there would be some kind of fact-finding going on by one of the fact-finders, either a judge or a jury, who would determine whether or not the currency was involved in a drug transaction. And, you know, we're 11 years into this. This has spanned almost a third of my career. 11 years now, and these guys haven't been tied to a drug transaction.
You know, Mr. Morocco's affidavit is thin. It doesn't say when he left college, how long he worked at any of the jobs, how much he made at any of the jobs, what his expenses were. So the court essentially found that it was inadequate as a matter of law. If you were given an opportunity to testify, present further evidence, what would that evidence be? Has he ever proffered what more he could say about his earnings, about... his savings?
Well, in the normal context, a witness would take the witness stand. There would be the direct examination, and then there would be a cross-examination. And the very skilled Mr. Kuhn could stand there and cross-examine him all day long, and either the finder of fact could find him credible or incredible. But on affidavits, how do you do that? How can you just look at an affidavit and say an affidavit's incredible on its face without looking at the person or even having them cross-examined? Now, you know, if you want to turn us into a society like the French, writing affidavits all day long, and the only trial you get is if it's a rape or a murder because those are passion crimes, you get a jury. But everything else is done by affidavit. You can't possibly anticipate every single criticism that's going to come from your opponent. I mean, it's impossible to write a bulletproof affidavit. And we have, I believe, a much better legal system after observing trials in the other legal system, where juries in America make decisions based on people who sit in front of them. And by the way, since forfeiture started as a country, we always had jury trials for forfeiture. I mean, I'm not suggesting some new invention for the 21st century.
But what would that evidence be?
What would the evidence be? Well, he graduated colleges. He went into cash businesses. He mowed lawns. He was involved in selling pizza. That's an all-cash business. People don't, you know, you're a pizza driver. You're going to show up and take a check, which could bounce. The pizza's been eaten, and you don't know what the story is in the bank in 14 days. I mean, you know, it's a classic story. People in cash businesses get cash, and that doesn't make them criminals. And we had that again in 506,000, USA versus 506,000. It was a pizza parlor. It generated $506,000 in cash. And by the way, try to buy something with cash as opposed to a credit card. You get more when you have cash. If you go to Arizona to buy cactus to bring it back to Illinois, you're going to get more saguaro cactuses, you will, with cash than you ever will with an American Express card. So I would suggest to you that this is a classic situation where somebody has to make a credibility determination based on the witness sitting on the witness stand. And, you know, we're excellent at that in this building.
Would there be some reason that they wouldn't put in an affidavit that, as we all know, people who work for cash, handymen, people that do repairs and do a lot of other things and work for cash, that he wouldn't want to expose that to tax?
Well, he
did
because he filed a claim. He actually filed a claim. He's actually sitting in front of the court. So his whole life has been opened by the discovery procedures here, and his whole life has been subject to scrutiny. And in all this time we've been here, he's been exposed. I see my white light is on, so I suspect I've been directed to sit down.
No, that's your rebuttal light. It's your time, Mr. Comey. If you want to spend it here on your opening, you can. Or you can reserve.
Okay, well, I just want to say he's exposed himself. If he doesn't want to expose himself, he doesn't file a claim. The minute you file a claim, you open your entire life to the scrutiny of these fine men.
Did he expose himself to how he got a lot of cash income?
Right.
Did he?
Privacy is over the minute you come here because of discovery.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Comey. Ms. Kuhn?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I want to address one issue raised by Mr. Comey right off the bat where he talks about some dog had an affinity for Jana Reno's purse. I know he's told that story in this court at least three times. That's not true. The article says that she was asked to furnish a $20 bill that underwent a chemical wash that revealed microgram or nanogram quantities. If the court would like, I would be happy to submit the article after the argument.
In the Supreme Court's very recent opinion in Florida versus Harris, the court states that the defendant, quote, must have an opportunity to challenge such evidence of a dog's reliability, whether by cross-examining the testifying officer or by introducing his own fact or expert witnesses, end quote. That is in the slip opinion at 8. In what sense did the defendants have that opportunity here?
Here they had a full opportunity to do all the discovery that they wanted. In fact, the discovery period was extended once at the claimant's request. The court in Harris didn't say there must be an evidentiary hearing. They said they must be given an opportunity. And here, there is the opportunity. They had full discovery. We had a suppression hearing in which case Mr. Comey was able to examine witnesses. He got to take depositions of our people, if he so chose. Did he have enough? If he had enough to survive summary judgment, he would have a trial. But we have the Rule 56 of the civil rules, which is the rule for summary judgment. And as the rules and this court has said, that's when you got to show your evidence, show what you have, show why you're entitled to a trial, show that you can create a dispute of material fact. And the claimant received a full opportunity to do that, and it failed.
You know, I really have some real concerns about the district court's treatment of Mr. Morocco's affidavit. He's not stating conclusions. He's stating facts. And it doesn't matter under our case law that they are self-serving facts or uncorroborated facts. What is wrong with this affidavit? Why did it deserve no credit on the issue of where the money came from?
I don't think that the district court gave it no credit. I think the district court looked at that as compared with the other evidence and went with the totality of circumstances approach that this court used in $30,670.
Yeah, well, that's the big question, isn't it? What's the effect of Harris on $30,760, because I read Harris as saying that defendants can challenge the dog's training, the dog's certification, its field performance, particular conditions under which the dog operated in this particular instance. I mean, is that consistent with our prior case law?
Yes, Judge, it's entirely consistent, and that's exactly what happened here. We presented full evidence of this dog's training, his performance in training, his performance in the field. And based upon that, this dog is right 97.8% or 99% of the time.
That's the operative word. You presented. But what about them?
They had every opportunity to challenge.
I don't know that is so. It seems to me that if there's a possibility that the science has changed, or if a particular defendant has evidence that of the type that was not presented in our 30,760 whatever case, should that defendant not be able to use that evidence to challenge the sniff? I mean, it just seems like district courts are giving preclusive effect to our opinion against persons who were not parties to the earlier case.
Well, I respectfully disagree. They had every opportunity here to challenge the $30,670. It can be challenged. I don't know exactly what that challenge will look like, but I know it's not this. This, the
well,
only
you
evidence.
Well, you would know if they had been permitted to do so, perhaps.
They had a full opportunity to respond to summary judgment. Judge Bucklow let them put in 3 affidavits 4 years after discovery closed. And those affidavits from a purported drug trainer with no formal education or training, from an animal neurophysiologist who has no background in chemistry or drugs, and a former DEA chemist who has no experience with dogs and has done no research on this matter whatsoever. That's their challenge. They chose to present that evidence. They could have presented whatever they wanted in response to summary judgment. This is what they chose. It's not enough. It's just not enough, as the district court found.
Why did the government use this 4-year time frame to assess Morocco's income and expenses? It seems very arbitrary and not at all complete, depending, of course, on his age, his work history. From his affidavit, it seems that his work history was more extensive than 4 years.
Well,
you know, there could be savings.
The reason I chose 4 years is based upon experience in the district court here. When we ask for longer, we get challenged, and we're generally given a 3 to 5 year range by the district court judges. Mr. Morocco had the choice to present any evidence he wanted to rebut what we put in there, that basically in the 4 years prior to the seizure, he spent more than $20,000 more than he earned, not to mention where this $100,000 came from. But he chose to submit this affidavit that contains literally no factual material whatsoever. It doesn't say when he started working. It doesn't say what his expenses were. It doesn't say where he worked. It doesn't even say that he made money. It just said, I had a job. And if it's very clear, it should be clear, if someone just submitted an affidavit and said, this is not drug money, or I made this money working, that wouldn't be enough. No rational juror would believe that that would be true in the face of the evidence against him. And that's the standard that the district court applied, the proper summary judgment standard, that what they presented, no rational juror would believe.
Well, it's all about the money. And I'm curious where the money came from, but I'm concerned about where the money went. I assume, you know, it was whoever they caught up with the courier, went and followed the money back to Mr. Morocco. And then what? What did they find when they searched or whatever they did with Mr. Morocco?
Well, Mr. Morocco was not present with the money. It was with a gentleman by the name of Vincent Phelan.
But that's who we're after here.
Well,
I mean, what did they find out about him as being when they were examining him or searching his house or doing something and didn't find anything?
He was stopped he was questioned on Amtrak at Union Station. He gave inconsistent answers, acted in a nervous manner. He lied about what he was carrying. He lied about how much he was carrying. He had it in a locked bag for which he had no key.
Well, whose money was it?
Well, Mr. Morocco and Mr. Phelan say it's Mr. Morocco's money.
Yeah.
Mr. Phelan was
okay,
carrying.
Okay, we'll just take either of them. I'm focusing more on Mr. Morocco, but did either of them get connected to drugs?
No. But it's not necessary that we prove up a drug crime.
I understand that. But when you find no drugs, now it goes back to the money. And instead of getting a second opinion or doing some scientific examination of this money, and put it in the bank. And that's basically destroyed what is the totality of the evidence here. Now we're arguing about scientific and stuff and whether but it's kind of hypothetical. The money itself was not preserved. And you say, well, that, what do they call it, methyl benzenite, benzidate, something rather, that dissipates.
Yes.
So wouldn't have made any difference or something. But I think there would be a certain amount of time, the time when they find no drugs for either of them. Maybe we better take a look at this money to make sure we can tie it to drugs. I don't understand how money gets contaminated anyway, but that's a chemical question, I guess.
Right. And as the court found in $30,670, if money is in close proximity to what they call the large quantity of drugs, it will pick up the odor of the drug on the money.
And
that's what the dog alerts to.
This menthol benzoate, is that how it's named? It apparently, this odor comes from something, a combination of something with cocaine.
With illicit cocaine. It's not real or illicit, whatever. Right.
I guess it's all illicit. And then it somehow attaches to the money for a while.
The odor does, yes.
Would it have been impossible to get another check on that money to do, not necessarily a dog sniff? Is there some kind of a scientific test you could do? Or?
Not that I'm aware of.
Really? When you find a bulk of money, I know you, maybe the $500,506 is obsolete, but it says clearly in there just because you got a pile of money can't mean you have to assume that it's illicit.
Right, and that's why we look at the combination of the courier factors, and we use a trained and reliable drug dog. This dog, using just his nose, finds drugs in hidden areas. That's what they do. And the fact that this money was hidden out of sight, where neither he nor the handler knew where it was, and he found it using just his nose.
I'm trying to envision the room. Is room with a bunch of cabinets or something?
Right. It's a long, narrow room, somewhat triangular. It's got cabinets along one side. It's got like a kitchen cabinet, cabinets, lower cabinets with a counter.
Yeah.
On one side. On the other side, there's tables, some file cabinets, a fax machine.
So there's a series of cabinets of some kind. And,
right.
And did they have other stuff in them?
Just general office supplies. It's what the Amtrak police use it for their roll call room.
Yeah. Well, and he went right to the one with the drugs in it.
He went around the perimeter of the room and stopped the one where the drugs are, started biting and scratching, which is his trained response. The dog was actually able to get the cabinet door open and grab that and was biting and pulling on the bag that contained the money. When they took the money out, he still kept going after the money. He didn't go back to the cabinet.
Okay. Well, it just seems that since the money is everything and they didn't find any drugs, that just putting it in the bank. You say he had every opportunity. I don't know when, how long it takes to dissipate and where it wouldn't make any difference to have another dog check it or do something. I guess you don't have to if that's all you... That just bothers me, but...
Well, that's the procedure that's been used for...
Yeah, I have no problem with that. They usually find drugs. And find that's how they... And there's no question, this was a great lead. Trouble is, it ran into a dead end.
Well, the drugs aren't always with the money.
Well,
sometimes the money comes from the transaction, sometimes going to the transaction.
Yeah, you say the drugs aren't always with the money, but this money had to be with it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it wouldn't have gotten that odor.
Right, that's correct.
So where'd it go?
The drugs, we don't know. We did not even know about a Mr. Morocco until this case was filed months later.
I see. All right. Somebody had the money, but who didn't? We say we. Who didn't? The cops knew, but you didn't.
The United States, we did not know Mr. Morocco was involved in this case until he filed his claim in this case.
Okay.
I see my time is up. Thank you very much. And I ask that this court affirm the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Coon. Mr. Comey, you want us to reevaluate $30,000.
Thank you. That would be my invitation.
Right. Now, if we're to do that, we've got to see whether the science has progressed significantly from the time of that decision to now. And my assessment of the case is that Mr. Angelos would be critical, as you've presented it so far, to establishing that there's been a change. But I don't see in his affidavit anything that suggests any post 30,000 studies that reevaluate the dog sniffing versus finding the currency. I understand his challenge perhaps to this case, but if for us to revisit the precedent, which is clearly an approach, Fifth Circuit has taken that approach, don't we need to have something suggesting that there is a studies of some sort that would indicate a change in the reliability factor?
Thank you for reading that affidavit. It's a most excellent question. And the reason it's most excellent is that the government's known about the contamination of the currency since he was their employee. So it's long known. The problem was 30,000 was decided on the basis of no opposition to summary judgment. So it's distinguishable based on the internal mechanism and procedural activity in the case. That claimant did not oppose summary judgment by providing all the things we did. In other words, we sat down and looked at that case and came up with the experts from the field who are capable of coming to court to contest that rationale. Because, after all, the government walks into every single forfeiture case and says it's pathognomonic when the dog sniffs it based on 30,000. And so we don't have to do anything more. You're not entitled to a trial. You're not entitled to a credibility determination. We're done. Dog sniffs, you're over. It doesn't make any difference what you do. So the reason we should reexamine 30,000 is...
Well, I'm not suggesting we shouldn't, but I just want to get the handle on what an expert, like, assuming he would be qualified under 702, I want to get a handle on what would be the basis to something post 30,000. I'm not saying he can't find it, Mr. Angelos, but I didn't see anything suggesting there are studies to challenge the reliability of the approach that 30,000 took.
Well, the problem is 30,000 took an approach without a person opposing summary judgment. In other words, there has to be a contest going on to avoid summary judgment. There has to be conflict that has to be resolved by a fact finder. And in that particular case, the court came down on the side of the government because there was no affidavit from Mr. Angelos. There was no documents from dog handlers and veterinarians. There was no ability to conduct a Daubert hearing, or if they wanted to, or a motion in limine, or even a trial to make a determination. But here, the only connection to drugs is the dog. In the entire case, the only thing that's supposed to reach, and that's important too to note, that the jurisprudence of this case is based on the jurisprudence existed before Hyde changed the law. And what happened here is this judge relied on the old case's totality of the circumstances. That's not the right standard. The right standard here is by a preponderance. And so you have to go beyond the probable cause determination. You have to reach up and get what the Supreme Court referred to in Harris as the well-known framework. I mean, if you read the Harris decision and then you superimpose it on top of ours, we're entitled to a hearing based on Harris alone. But going beyond that, the Supreme Court points out all the problems that are inherent in this case. And the author of that decision relied on what we find if we take a look at the footnote, which is in Harris, which is footnote number 3, talks about one person in the United States coming up with a detailed list of what should be involved. Well, and as we know, two lawyers can't agree on anything. Two scientists can't agree on anything. Generally, they generally fight with each other. The court also took in our expert witnesses' material that was included in the briefs and wrote a decision that said that we're going to have a hearing where all this information is going to come in and the fact finder will make a decision. And so if you follow Harris as your roadmap, you can create a modern 21st century way to approach this problem in the circuit, and you might even suggest the government not destroy the currency so its laboratory can do it. I mean, it doesn't make any difference where we bring in Stanford Angelos or any other expert from the chemical community. They're going to say, and I'm going to answer your question directly, when that money goes to the Federal Reserve, if people have used cocaine, it gets on the rollers, and from the rollers, it gets on the rest of the currency. And Mr. Angelos, in his affidavit, described that as being the problem in the United States. All of our currency is contaminated because of the cocaine epidemic. So innocent people end up like Miss Reno. And your point is very good. Why don't they just send it to the laboratory on day one?
All right, I think your time is
expired. Oh, I hit the red light. Well, let me thank you for having me back again. It's always a pleasure to see all of you. And best wishes for a happy summer away from the building doing something fun.
Well, we still have to be here.
I like the old days when we left and didn't come back till the first Monday in September.
That's a time long ago. Judge Roedner has a question for Mr. King.
Forgive me, but this has been bothering me, and it's on my mind. But at the top of page 31 of the red brief, there are two percentages given for deny or Denny.
It's Denny. He's Czechoslovak.
Oh, for Denny's reliability, 97.8% and 67%. What's the difference between what these two numbers are measuring? Because they seem to be measuring the same thing, and yet they're divided by 30 percentage points. So if you could explain that to me, I could sleep tonight.
Sure. The 67%, if you take all of the sniff searches he conducts, and we count as positives only those where after which drugs, actual drugs are found, or money that we know is tainted with drugs. That's 67%. The other 30%, that represents the money that he has found in the field, where there is no definitive way to scientifically test whether or not there are drugs on there other than his nose, which goes along with what the Eldon Harris is. You want to look at the dog's record in training, so you know when he does alert and does a not alert, if it's a false positive or as they determine a false negative. So that's why we put both percentages in there.
I've started something.
Of course he does.
We don't agree with the government's numbers, which we would show at a hearing. And Harris case, the dog hit one time and hit a second time. There was nothing in the truck. So the Supreme Court was confronted with a 50-50. at that time, which I think is why they recommended the hearing for the evidence to come out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both and co-counsel. Case is taken under advisement.